Welcome to the Where Humanity Meets Technology podcast, where we talk to business leaders about cybersecurity, data management, and advanced digital solutions to provide strategies to increase the profitability of your company. Now, here's your host, Maurice Hamilton, the CEO of Infinivate Consultancy Services.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our podcast where we call it Where Humanity Meets Technology. This is a podcast show where I interview CEOs, CIOs, CTOs, and business leaders to discuss real-life solutions, companies using humanity with technology for the betterment of mankind. Topics may vary from data management, cybersecurity, custom software development, and digital solutions. And we also like to discuss trends in technology and how that utilization of those topics actually come into play, with especially with humanity. My name is Maurice Hamilton. I'm your host, and I've been in the industry for a little bit over 30 years now, and I've actually seen many changes in the technology field. And I like to share that information and talk to my guests, and they actually come in and they actually talk about how they can share the information, because we've all seen a lot of changes. And we want to talk about how we've actually seen the technology actually being utilized for the betterment of mankind. Our guest today is Curtis Minder. And Curtis is the CEO and co-founder of GroupSense. Did I have that right, Curtis?
Yeah, I drew the short straw.
Okay. So it's really awesome to meet with you. I had a chance to kind of like take a look at your background there. And we can actually start there. If I can actually open up the conversation and let's have a, what I call a genesis moment. And let's see if we can go back and kind of pick your brain a little bit, and you could tell our audience, how did you actually get started in cybersecurity? And maybe you can shed a little bit of light on that.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up in, first of all, thanks for having me. Thank you, Maurice. I appreciate it. Yeah. So I grew up in central Illinois, not Chicago, corn and soybeans, Illinois. When I was a kid, my dad worked at a factory. It was actually a flour mill. And when I visited his work, he was in this non-climate controlled 110 degree room, moving 50 pound sacks of flour from one conveyor belt to another, whatever. And I admired him for that. But when I went to my mom's work, she worked as an accountant. And I didn't really understand what that was at the time when I was a kid, but she sat in an air-conditioned room and had a cup of coffee in one hand and was typing on a calculator with the other. And I was like, I don't know what that is, but I want to do that typing thing because I don't want to lift a sack of flour. And so back then, you know, it was the early 90s. Back then, we didn't really have that many computers in the school. You know, you in the library, you had them, but they did have keyboard and formatting class, which was on an actual typewriter back then. And I took that class, and then I took every computer course I could. The high school I went to didn't have very many computers. There was a vocational school in the town nearby that I went to do advanced. I'm doing the quote things with my fingers, computer classes there. And then the way that I got into what is now called cybersecurity, back there, there wasn't even a job for this, was one of my first jobs after, you know, I did the cliche sort of fast food thing for a while that you do when you're a kid. And there was an ad in the paper. I mean, this is really dating me, right? I'm looking at jobs that ads in printed papers for a systems admin role at an internet company, an early internet company that was doing internet access for the region. And I took that job. And so over time, I worked at four of these different internet companies before I moved to Chicago. And we were chasing bad guys and routers, you know, in 1992, 1993. Back then, the bad guys, Maurice, were, you know, kids who were trying to prove how smart they were. Mm-hmm. They weren't cyber, you know, organized cyber gangs or nation states, but the principle was the same. And I've always found that fascinating and interesting. And that sort of started the ball rolling in my cyber career.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because as soon as you said that, back in the day, and I remember those days too, around 92, 93-ish, when the internet really started to come in play. And I thought about that movie with Matthew Broderick, War Games. Remember that movie?
Of course. That was one of my favorite movies. Yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm.
One of the original cyber hacking movies. So that was interesting you brought that up. And we have something else in common. I actually grew up in the Chicagoland area too.
Oh, no kidding.
So we'll talk about that later. But that was my wife is actually the farmlands in Illinois. So nice. We have that in common there. So Curtis, I actually want to kind of go to want to do some education for the audience here. And I know we hear the term Digital Risk Protection Services, DRPS. And on your website, you guys actually kind of listed a couple of different variations of that. want to protect the earth, the businesses, protect government. And when I saw something that caught my eye, and it mentioned that you serve as a negotiator for ransomware. Without taking a really, really deep dive, can you actually tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So we, you know, the work we do in our core business is it sort of puts us right in the nexus of the ransomware economy. There's an underground economy where people are selling stolen network access to the ransomware operators. And there's also where they're monetizing the ransomware platforms, what they call ransomware as a service. And like I said, to make the story short, we have visibility to that in our day job, we started getting pulled into the ransomware cases themselves. This happened a few years ago. And what we learned was there weren't very many folks that understood very well how to interact with the threat actors when that was necessary. When you decided, yeah, we probably need to talk to these guys and see if we can get to lower the number because we're going to need to pay them something or we're going to go out of business, right? And that's often the case for a lot of companies where their systems are all locked and they can't operate unless they have to do it relatively quickly too. They can't rebuild or they'll go out of business. And so that also sort of snowballed us on us. And we ended up becoming, you know, a favorite with a lot of the cyber insurance companies to come in and help interact with the bad guy, be the liaison between the victim and the bad guys that attack them and try to drive the number down and get a tangible result that everybody can agree on.
Interesting. So, and because now I'm thinking about the role of like a special agent, like FBI, CIA, when they actually go back and they have to do negotiations for any kind of a terrible activity that's actually, or a terrible event. And I'm thinking about this, you probably have to do some kind of initial profiling. Mm-hmm. And I know that one of the aspects of your role is to actually go back out there and identify and say, okay, I need to know who my enemy is. I need to know what they look like, where are they located, what's their modus operandi, you know. Do you actually go back and pull all that together so that way you have more data with your staff and say, okay, let's know who we're dealing with? Can you tell me a little bit about how that works with you guys?
Yeah, I mean, yes, exactly. You nailed it. And Digital Risk Protection Services is a fancy name for a cyber intelligence product, right? So part of our job is doing cyber intelligence. And as part of that, it is the threat actor profiling. So we already have a lot of knowledge about these folks and where they're operating from and how their organizations work. We already have that at our fingertips. And in some cases, we meet new bad guys and we got to learn quick. But we have the tools to do that. That's part of our day job. I think in addition to that, when you're talking about negotiation, whether you're doing a business negotiation or a hostage negotiation, you know, understanding who you're dealing with is helpful. And that's the attribution that you talked about. But also having some form of empathy and understanding that person's position, motivations, and sort of immediate surroundings, like their lifestyle, their business, whatever is driving their behavior is important too. I also want to say that empathy is not the same as sympathy. We don't have sympathy for them, but empathy, meaning I understand them. I understand why they're doing what they're doing. And I understand what their job is like. And I'm doing the quote things with my fingers because most of these for ransomware, for example, these actors are operating in an organization that's very structured. It's like a job. And so you have to understand all those mechanics and it helps drive the outcomes.
Interesting. So with that thought and that comment in mind there, and I think that one of the big differences that people need to understand would be you have your web or the surface web, you have your dark web, and then you have your deep web. Can you explain to the audience Well, we pretty much know what the regular web is, but kind of like give us a basic scenario and explain to us what are the differences there and kind of give us some details about what happens behind the scenes.
Yeah. And unfortunately, these tend to get a little bit intermingled and misused by vendors and folks. Just they're kind of loosely used. But the general consensus for these definitions is the dark web is a label that goes on a network that runs on top of the internet. There's multiple kinds of these, but the concept behind this network that runs on top of the internet is that you need special software to access it. You can't do it from a normal browser. You have to have a special browser and you have to have certain configurations and understand how to get on it. And two of the biggest examples of those are Tor, which stands for the Onion Router. That's the traditional dark web that everybody talks about. There's another one called I2P. And there's a handful of others as well. But most of the illicit activity occurs on Tor, which is part of the dark web. Deep web it doesn't require special software, but it requires special access. And that might just be a username and password. it might be a site where you have to be vetted by someone or recommended by someone to get into. They're typically regular web properties that require some level of special access. And that also includes, deep web typically also includes any dynamic content. So that would be Twitter, for example, would be considered, or Reddit would be considered deep web. Another way to look at it is deep web is often sites that are not indexed by a search engine. So those would be sites that you can't, the search engine can't get to because there's a wall in the way, like authentication, like we talked about, or dynamic content that the search engine doesn't want to index because it's changing so frequently it would mess up the search algorithms, like Twitter, right?
So in essence, the deep web, because you mentioned about encryption or any kind of authentication in order to get to it, it could theoretically be some good information, like top secret information as well.
It doesn't necessarily. Also, you know, Facebook is deep web, right? So it's not necessarily bad, right? Deep web is not bad. It's just a form of access. And where deep web is bad is where those forums are soliciting bad behavior or organizing what we would call kinetic attacks, things like that.
Okay.
Organized groups. Yeah.
Got it. And Curtis, I saw a TED talk that you actually did, and I think it was earlier this year, and you actually were in front of the audience and you said, let me paint the picture for you as to what happens when you get that, when you come to the office and you click on the button, you said, what's wrong with my system? And then a person next to you says, what's wrong with my system? And then everybody figured out that something's gone wrong. Can you actually explain to the audience a little bit about what happens when that process, when you've been infected, when something has gone wrong? What does that look like? Can you paint a general description of that?
Sure. And I apologize in advance to any of the listeners who have experienced this and they are going to have PTSD. Being a victim to these kinds of attacks is traumatic, legitimately traumatic. So just imagine you come into the office, like you said, and for whatever reason, nothing works. You can't use your email. You can't access your files. You may not be able to use your payroll systems, things like this. All these things break. And you will find, typically on a desktop of a machine or something, a text file. And it'll say, read me a ransom or read ransom text. And inside that text file, you'll have a note that is a ransom note that explains that some bad guy has broken into your system. The first thing that they do is they typically take as much of your data as they can out of your network. They take a copy of it. And then the next thing they do is they deploy this malware that when they hit a button, it locks all of the files. It uses a form of encryption to do this. And the only way to unlock the files is to pay them a ransom, and they will give you the encryption key to reverse that. So that's kind of what occurs. The first impact is obvious. One is operational, right? Nothing works. So that's pretty obvious. There are also these other impacts that a lot of companies don't realize are going to occur or are not prepared for. I call it the ransomware blast radius. So if that initial operational impact's the center, right? The next circle is sort of brand or customer confidence. So they took a copy of your data. One of the things they're going to say in the ransom note is that they're going to say, if you don't contact us and make a deal, we're going to start leaking that data. Mm-hmm. If that data contains things like your employees' information, your customers' information, your partners' information, you're going to lose friends really quick, right? So there's this sort of reputational piece. The employee piece that people don't think about is, let's say your systems are locked and you can't make payroll. Maybe you can't make payroll for a couple of weeks while you're trying to figure this thing out. And sometimes these things do take a couple of weeks to resolve. What does that do to employee confidence and morale? And what if you have people who actually leave as a result of this? What does that cost your business to recruit, rehire new people? And so some of these things last a long time. They could take intellectual property that doesn't harm you right now, but in 5 years, when your competitor has a copy that they shouldn't, right? That could be an issue. And so it's really harmful. And it doesn't matter the size of the business. It is extremely harmful.
Just listening to what you're talking about there and describing it, it's got to be horrendous for an executive of an organization to come in. And like you said, it not only impacts the company and their employees, but it impacts vendors and it impacts the customers. So everybody that's involved with that organization is impacted. We all are impacted indirectly when you think about it.
That last point you made, I think, is something that is also getting overlooked at a national level. And that is most of these, the people who perpetrate these attacks are doing that from an unfriendly country that we're not going to be able to extradite them, right? 80%+ of these attacks are coming out of Russia. And the threat actors have been given this sort of unofficial amnesty that Russia allows them to do these attacks as long as they don't attack Russian assets, right? The quid pro quo for that amnesty, we believe, is that that first part that they do where they take a copy of your data, guess who else gets a copy of your data?
Would it be the Russian government?
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you say it affects all of us, that's how it affects all of us. These companies, no matter their size, are, you know, the amount of data that's been taken out of the country as a result of these attacks is exabytes of data. And some of these companies are suppliers to our government contractors. They're the people that they're architecture firms that build our roads and bridges, and the plans for those things are overseas. It's not good. It's not good.
Interesting. I have a question for you, but I don't want to throw this off the topic here. So sure. Remind me about TikTok. I don't want to date the podcast here, but I know TikTok is a really big thing. I have a couple of questions for you on that one. So now that we're talking about what happens, let's go to a little bit more positive part of that and say, how can you actually stop this from happening? You mentioned two-factor authentication, and you also mentioned something about when you actually, for example, you want to sign up with a vendor and you're typing your email address into the site. You said that is probably one of the worst things that you could possibly do. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about what are some factors and something that what you call the word was cybersecurity pitch hygiene. That's what it was.
Being
patriotic and actually having that hygiene there. Can we talk a little bit about that cybersecurity hygiene there, Curtis?
Yeah. So one of the things, you know, actually, I'm glad you asked that after this last question where I kind of went on that tangent about the Russian, you know, taking the data, because what we found was when we do these cases, we usually get a pretty good idea of how the bad guy got in. And in most cases, it was preventable, and not preventable by buying some fancy software or some, you know, super firewall. That's not what happened. In most cases, it was some basic, what the word we're using is cyber hygiene, things that could have been done by the organization that would have made it much more difficult for the bad. And by the way, most of these are opportunistic. So the bad guy's not picking you. You just happen to be easy. And so the key is don't be easy and don't be a low-hanging fruit. And those cyber hygiene things, of course, if you've listened to the news, the two-factor authentication goes a long way to protect, you know, from these types of attacks. The other one that you mentioned, which if you hear some of the ones on the news where they're talking about like the bad guys hacked into this company. Mm-hmm. And then later, if you read the fine print, they didn't really hack in. They logged in. They logged in because somebody in that company took their corporate email address and they used it to log in or to create an account on a third party site that isn't related to the business. And I always pick on iloveknitting.com because it's not assigned to anything yet. So iloveknitting.com. Well, and they might use what do people do? We have so many passwords we have to deal with. So we reuse our passwords or reuse some variation of the same password across a bunch of sites. So that's what happens is they use their corporate credential on something that's not related to the business and use a password that's similar to the one that they use at work. The bad guys hack iloveknitting.com. They pull out all the corporate emails and then they use those to fuzz the password and log in. And by the way, two-factor would fix that, but you still don't want your employees using their corporate credentials on anything unrelated to the business. And you certainly don't want them reusing passwords, which brings me to the third one, which is using some form of password management. And so just going back to the patriotic part is, you know, in the TED talk, I challenge the audience to say, because the opponent is an unfriendly country who is taking our money and disrupting our operations and stealing our data, and there are things that we can do as individuals on a daily basis to stop that, we should. As a form of civic duty or patriotism. And that's kind of the thing I challenge people in a TED talk with.
That's those nuggets of, if you listen to our podcast here, remember what he just said in the last 5 minutes, because now we're talking about preventative measures. So that's cybersecurity hygiene. That's very, very important there. So I want to kind of shift a little bit over to some of the services that you guys provide. And we talked a few minutes ago about how we could possibly work together in some of these areas there. And we talked about digital risk protection, but I something that caught my eye and I thought about this and I said, wow, that is so prevalent. And it was executive protection. Curtis, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So as you know, what digital risk protection services is designed to do, or the reason why it's you know, a product at all, is actually the use case I just gave is a good example, is most of the cyber attacks that are successful are predicated by the bad guy or the threat actor having access to information that they shouldn't have. So that's like that credential that I told you, they shouldn't have that. And, but also it's not always bad. It's not like they hacked into something all the time. Sometimes it's your employees doing something that they don't mean to. For example, let's say you give one of your employees a special project and they realize they're in over their head. Mm-hmm. And so they have a buddy at another company that they think can help them. And so they go to Trello and they open up an account with Trello because you can get a free account with Trello. I don't know if you know what Trello is, but it's like a collaborative tool.
Okay.
You don't have to pay anything. You can open up an account with Trello. And they start sharing information on Trello with this other person, but they don't lock that Trello board, right? Well, that Trello board is open to the internet and it contains your corporate data. It contains people's names, maybe. It contains a project you're working on. It might contain source code because they're software developers. And the bad guys find it and they use it in their attack against you, right? So digital risk protection exists to find that when it occurs and help you clean it up, so the bad guys don't find it first. That's the main purpose. So then if you extrapolate that out, if you look at sort of the statistics, the biggest risk to most businesses is the people of a business. So starting with the executives, and we also now have products that go all the way down to the individual employee level, and try to look at their digital risk footprint. And if their behavior online could be used against the business or people around them, sometimes it's not them. So maybe it's their nephew or their cousin posts something on Facebook that is compromising to the business. They need to know about that so they can mitigate it. So we've created a product around that. It does include executives, but also like high net worth individuals. It also includes like mayors of cities and people like that. And we even have some celebrities who use the product.
Interesting. Yeah. I like how you said you can need to scale it down to some of the other employees in the company.
Yep.
And this actually parlays into my other question I said a few minutes ago. I get to open the door a little sooner here. When I'm thinking about, you mentioned Facebook and like LinkedIn and some of the basic social media. What about TikTok? You hear a lot of things going on right now where some governors of different states are saying, no more TikTok on a federal website. And can you actually elaborate? I know it's still early in the process with what's going on there, but can you actually tell us a little bit about how that works, Curtis?
Well, so TikTok is, there's a company in China that acquired a US company called Musical.ly. I don't know if you remember that company. Mm-hmm. If you have kids, you probably do. And you're probably having PTSD from that too. Because I do remember Musical.ly. And so, you know, they rebranded as TikTok and it's a social media tool with, you know, basically where you can create these really short kind of catchy videos. The problem is in order to use that application, you have to, I'm sure you've seen this with other applications on your phone, for example, you give it permission when you agree to a bunch of terms and conditions. And when you download it, it gives it permission to give access to a lot of other things about you and on your phone, your location, turning on your mic without your permission, getting a copy of your contacts database. All of that information is then going over to China, which we don't have any control over. And it's well known, and that's why companies like Huawei and stuff like that are under scrutiny, that the Chinese government does have a lot of control over these companies and a lot of influence over these companies. And so the concern is that data, not unlike the ransomware data that I talked about in Russia, could be used against us in a cyber offensive.
Wow. So that opens the door for, not only do we have like the ransomware and all these different cyber attacks, now do you have espionage and you have all kind of other ways that people can actually get in and tap into your information. And it could be just to find out who you are, just to get your information, just to know.
Impersonation is one of the biggest attack vectors, just impersonating someone. So, and that's something that the executive protection product focuses on too. So let's say so this is a really good example. Let's say you're an executive for a very large company and someone gets enough information about you that they can create a Twitter account that looks just like you and talks just like you and all of these. And what they'll do is they'll slowly over time start gaining followers, some of which will be your staff because they don't know the difference between that Twitter account and your real Twitter account. And once they start getting people that are in your regular daily network that are actually part of your circle, it gives that particular account credibility. And then they'll say something that is materially damaging to your business on Twitter, and it's not you, right? It's somebody else that did that. And so finding that impersonation early and removing that account from Twitter is part of the executive protection product.
Interesting. I can't tell you how many times you're watching the news and something comes out about a celebrity and they said, that wasn't me. And sometimes I question, they said, you know, you don't want to own up to it. But in that case, it may not have been them. You know, it could have been
entirely plausible that someone impersonated them. Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. So now, okay. That's good to know that. And some of the other services you guys have, and this is really big because I know there's a big election that happened down in Brazil. I have some developers in that area. And you have Lula da Silva, then you have Bolsonaro, the other guy. And now we're talking about...
When that election was occurring, the day that was occurring, mm-hmm. I was at the International Bar Association conference where I was speaking. And the lawyers that I was on the stage with were all from Brazil. And so I was learning as like play by play as that election was occurring, and they were strong opinions on both sides. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating to witness.
It's amazing to see what's happening right now, months after the election has taken place. But it brings up a really good thing. And you guys talk about election protection there. And we one of the most contentious points, and we talk about politics here, is still election results. And I don't want to go off in a deep end, but sometimes I look at some of the states where you have the election results and they could tell you 3 hours after the polls close exactly, I mean, almost to like 90, 95% what the election results are. And then you have some states where the elections actually, it could be weeks and weeks later. When this weeks and weeks later, it actually opens the door for doubt. And so when you think about election protection, maybe you can actually shed a little bit of light on it, because I always think about blockchain. I always think about encryption in the future of how people can actually protect their information where they can vote and their vote is pretty much secure. Maybe you could actually talk a little bit about that, Curtis, and actually talk about how we can actually, or what we could do to actually protect our election results.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to be careful on this topic, as you know, Maurice,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
because it's a heated topic and has a lot of political attachment to it. And we try to, you know, to the best of our ability, remain as objective as we can mm-hmm. with these things. But, you know, contrary to some of the stories you hear, the election infrastructure itself, if you took an election machine by itself and you gave it to one of the hackers at DEF CON, which is something they do in the election village, and you gave them unfettered access, unmonitored and unfettered access to that machine for an infinite amount of time, they will break it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're going to find problems with that machine. They're going to break it. But that's not the environment of the election. These machines are carefully monitored. Nobody's coming in with USB drives and plugging them in the back. This is not happening. Mm-hmm. And they're not connected to networks and they're not connected to wireless. The wireless in most of these machines, I'm not an expert, but I have done some work on this. Most of these machines, they don't have wireless at all, or the wireless components are disabled at the BIOS level before they're booted. So nobody's from China is hacking in and changing our election results, right? And I'll tell you the biggest issue, and we heard about this in the 2016 election, was that they don't have to do that to influence votes. They do it with misinformation and disinformation and mm-hmm. manipulation. It's cheaper for them to do that. They don't have to break into networks. They don't have to be physically present anywhere. They're using, in that particular election cycle, they're using very traditional manipulation tactics that sort of the rush, actually it originated in Germany during the World War II era. They're using very traditional manipulation and propaganda tactics and they're a long term. They use a lot of, they actually start months and months and months in advance building these programs and campaigns and groups and things like that. And then they start manipulating them. So that's what we're looking for is sort of the manipulation and disinformation stuff and working with the social media companies to remove it. And that sounds really sexy, but I'll tell you what most of the time this is tactically used for is, let's say in New York, someone tweets that the polling station on 35th and 4th Avenue is closed when it's not. That's misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody will see that tweet and they'll go like, well, I can't vote. And they'll stay home, right? Or they'll tweet that polling station is on fire. You have to go to this other polling station. It's not on fire. And if they go to that other polling station, they're not allowed to vote because they have to vote at the one that they're assigned to. And so by the time they get back to that, they lose a vote, right? So those are little bitty things that happen during the election where we're constantly monitoring these activities and taking those things offline.
And then
issuing a correction. That was not true, you know, and making sure that everybody votes and gets to the right polling station. So that's a lot of times it's that kind of tactical stuff that we're doing.
Okay. And you mentioned that it's like the 18-month, 3-month daily election and then post-election where you have like those 4 different phases that you actually go back to kind of like kill that misinformation.
Yep. And don't get me wrong. We are chasing down botnets and things that are creating fake accounts. And we're doing that stuff on the background too, months in advance of the election. We're taking down those false accounts way in advance. They're being created by robots in Russia and things like that.
Excellent. Okay. So this is some really good information here. We actually talked about the differences between the webs. We talked about how you can protect your data. We talked about some misnomers out there about the election. And we talked about how people can actually really basically protect their information and how information can actually be misconstrued. So one thing that I didn't ask you about was you personally, I see that you like to mountain bike and you have a motorcycle. You like to really get out there and hike and you're an outdoorsy type guy.
Yeah, definitely. That's why I relocated to Colorado. But I you know, my day job requires me to travel quite a bit. So I'm not here to enjoy those things as often as I would like. I do have a bad habit with the motorcycles and I tend to plant them around the country. So I have some in Illinois and I have some in DC and I have some. So yeah, I have a real bad problem with the motorcycle habit.
That's pretty well. It's good, especially with the nature, where you live and actually being able to go outside sometimes with the different seasons, it does make a difference there. So Curtis, this has been I don't know if you want to add anything else to what we talked about here. We talked about a lot of different topics here, and I definitely want to keep it short and sweet. You gave us a lot of great information here. Did you have anything else you want to add in here?
Other than just to reinforce the cyber hygiene stuff, just really take a minute to update the software when your phone asks you to update your software. And when your browser tells you it's time to update, like just do it as soon as possible. If you have time, check out my TED Talk. It takes 15 minutes and it gives you a breakdown of like the 5 things you can do as an individual to protect yourself, but also everyone in the country.
Excellent. And you mentioned that during the TED Talks, you said they don't ask you to update your data at 3 o'clock in the afternoon for no reason at all.
Right. Right.
You know, you think of it as an inconvenience, but it's not an inconvenience. It's a convenience.
Right.
Interesting. Curtis, this has been awesome. I really want to thank you for your time here, the knowledge and information. And I'm excited because I'm thinking about even for the future, how we can possibly work together some different opportunities when it comes to cybersecurity. But this is
me too. That would be great. Thank you, Maurice.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you. It's been a great conversation. And we want to thank you. So everybody, thank you for having a warm welcome for Curtis Mender here. And as we mentioned before, he's the CEO and co-founder of GroupSense. And don't forget to like us and listen to our other podcasts. And we'll talk to you guys soon. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. To catch all the latest from your host, connect with Maurice on LinkedIn at Maurice Hamilton. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.